Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Gravity Commons Podcast. It's Ben Sternke. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm actually all alone today. My fellow co-hosts, Matt Tebbe and Christy Penley, have both abandoned me cruelly, unusually. No, just kidding. They are, Matt is in the Bahamas. He's on vacation. Doesn't that sound nice? And Christy is with 15 high schoolers in the Dominican Republic. I don't think that sounds like a vacation. So anyway, it's just me. It's actually kind of appropriate for it to just be me because I was actually the only one on this interview with Lee C. Camp, and I'm excited to bring it to you. I had a lot of fun recording this interview with Lee, and we end up talking about, man, just a lot of different things, ethics and human flourishing and habits. It kind of all focused around some of the themes that I think that revolve around a lot of Lee's work, which is just that it's basically just like how to be a good person. What does human flourishing look like? What does it mean to live the good life? And how do we pursue that? So I am eager to bring that interview to you. Before I do, though, I just wanted to take an opportunity once again to invite you to join us. Matt and I think Christy's going to be there for a little bit, but Matt and I will be there the whole time. We're going to be at Theology Beer Camp, or I've also seen it named Theology Camp because I think, maybe the beer throws people off. The beer is definitely optional, but it will definitely be present, is my understanding. This is the first time that we're going to be going to this gathering, but we're excited to be invited out. The Gravity Commons Podcast is one of the featured, they call them God Pods, because they're kind of silly and nerdy, which I kind of like. Feels like our vibe out there. And so anyway, we're one of the podcasts that's going to be out there at Theology Beer Camp. It's kind of a, one of the people that came a few years ago says that it's some of the best minds in academic progressive theology meet some of the most dynamic theology podcasts surrounded by a loving and inclusive community in a way that stimulates your mind and fills your heart, leaving you longing for each moment of your life to become its beautiful potential. That sounds lovely. So I hope you'll join us there. That's details. It is October 17th through the 19th in Denver, Colorado. Elia Delio is going to be speaking there. Brian McLaren, Diana Butler Bass, lots of others, lots of podcasts. We're really excited to be out there. And in addition to coming to hear the speakers and such, it's also a time to hang out with us. And so if you come, do let us know, and we can find a time. We'll have a Gravity Commons hangout. We'll figure out where we're going to be. But for that to happen, we need you all to come. So to get all the information, you can go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp, gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. That'll take you to the registration page for the conference, for the event, for the gathering. And please note this, use the code GravityHobbit, all caps, all one word, GravityHobbit, to get $25 off your tickets, $25 off registration by using that very silly code, Gravity Hobbit. All right. I think that's all I need to draw your attention to today, friends. I do hope that you will enjoy this interview with Lee C. Camp. Lee C. Camp joins us again on the Gravity Commons Podcast today. Lee is an award-winning teacher and professor of theology and ethics at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. Lee is also the host of No Small Endeavor, which is an acclaimed podcast series exploring the habits, practices, and dispositions that facilitate human flourishing, aka the good life. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. This is Lee's second time on the podcast. We talked with him back in 2020 about his book, Scandalous Witness, A Little Political Manifesto for Christians. Lee, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you, Ben. It's very nice to be with you again. Appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, glad to be able to chat. Just tell us a little bit about the podcast show, No Small Endeavor. I think when we last talked with you, both of our podcasts had different names. We were the Gravity Leadership Podcast at that point, and your show was called The Tokens Show. I wonder if you could maybe by way of introducing what the show is about, maybe talk about the name change and why it was significant for the show, and then, you know, what kind of the trajectory the show is on right now.
Yeah, so the show actually started, Token Show started back in 2008 as a live variety show here in Nashville. So we would have like a Nashville house band, and but it was a variety show that was geared around theological questions and topics. And so we had house band, vocal performances, little comedic sketch, and interviews with authors, theologians, philosophers, and poets, and things of that sort. And so we've been doing that for years. And then 2020, we started a podcast. And by the end of the 2020, we were on Nashville Public Radio. And then in the last year, we've gotten a deal with PRX. So we're kind of in national syndication currently. I think we're on, I don't know, 34, 37 public radio stations currently around the country and the podcast. The podcast is long format interview with all sorts of folks, as you indicated, talking about, you know, exploring what it means to live a good life. And but the name change that you asked about, yeah, so Token Show, the name Tokens came from a line from the lawyer and lay theologian William Stringfellow, who was just a remarkable human being part of the 20th century. And Stringfellow had this line where he would talk about how, you know, kind of doing the work of theology, he said that where there's celebration of progress, we may need to speak words of caution and critique. And where there is only despair, we may need to speak words of hope, looking for tokens of the resurrecting power of God in the world. And so the token there was an allusion to Stringfellow's line where, you know, how can we point to tokens of the hope of God in the world, of the power of God in the world, in the culture in which we find ourselves. So it was a perfect fit for what we were doing. But one of the things that we discovered in 2020 was that especially following the murder of George Floyd, was this kind of reticence of saying, what is this show? And the name Tokens connoted tokenism to a lot of folks.
Oh, yeah.
And so we heard that enough in rapid succession. And this was about the time where we were trying to do this deal with PRX and National Radio Syndication that we realized, you know, that we're just going to be shooting ourselves in the foot if we insist upon holding on to a name, even though we had invested a lot in the brand and all that kind of stuff. But so we started looking for something else. And I'm really glad we changed it because I think the new name, No Small Endeavor, points really well to what we're trying to point people to in the show.
Yeah. All right. So our official topic for today's conversation is habits and the nature of human flourishing, which is obviously part of, you know, what the show is about that you do every week. And so I wonder if we could just take that first part, take the last part first. What is the nature of human flourishing? What is it about that phrase that makes it an attractive phrase for you? What do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean by human flourishing?
Yeah. Well, so my academic discipline in ethics, ethics since the Enlightenment especially, became this sort of discipline. You know, I'm painting with a broad brush, but a broad brush that I think is somewhat accurate nonetheless. Looking for kind of timeless universal rules and principles that we're supposed to keep, you know, do this, don't do that. And while rules and principles are still an important part of living life, ethics historically was a much more interesting discipline. And it was simply asking the question, going back to Greeks and Romans and lots of other traditions, you know, Moses and plenty of Eastern traditions. The question was, what does it mean to live life? And what does a good life mean? And what is it? What does a good life entail? And so there's been lots of ways of trying to get to an answer to that question, but these various traditions have asked that same existential perennial question of what does it mean to live a good life? And what does it really look like to live a life that's a life worth living and a life that we can say this is a flourishing human life? And so when we talk about flourishing, it's this sort of sense of a set of holistic concerns that is going to concern every aspect of our lives. Because, you know, we all know this from experience, that if you have some sort of grave, let's say, social, relational dysfunction that's in your life, then, you know, your life just can't flourish in the way that it is if you have healthy, constructive relationships and friendships. Yeah. If you're refusing to care for your body, then your brain doesn't work as well. Your work isn't going to go as well, and life is not going to go as well. So flourishing asks questions about body and care for the body, along with relationships. It's going to ask questions about every aspect of our lives. And so that's why, you know, we talk to philosophers and theologians, but we also talk to psychiatrists, psychologists, poets, artists, who are all bringing various ways of asking what does a good life mean and what's a good life entail. And so it's one of the things that's so remarkable about it is how you can have people from such disparate and different traditions and different and disparate fields and who will kind of say similar things. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a remarkable kind of experiment in saying, what can we learn from different people about what it means to live a life that looks something like a flourishing life?
Yeah. What happened? You know, you mentioned that like ethics used to be, you know, more focused on the good life, you know, the flourishing life, that kind of a thing. But you indicated something changed along the way. I don't know if it would be interesting to get into that. Like what happened along the way? Like,
yeah.
Do you have a sense of that you could share with us?
Well, one of the ways that a lot of people will talk about that is that with the rise of the Enlightenment, you have this sort of, what some people call the eclipse of narrative. That is that historically, the way moral formation occurred was by telling stories about who were the heroes and who were the people that embody the kind of people we're trying to be and become. But what happens in the starting kind of 16th, 17th century is that you have with the breakdown of Christendom and the breakdown of, for good and for ill, we can talk about that in various ways, but that happens historically. And then you began to have this all sorts of warring going on. And you have people begin to ask, can't we find a way to have a peaceable community that isn't dependent upon what they would call, you know, superstitious traditions?
Yeah.
Can't we find something that all rational people can agree on? And so there are lots of philosophical pursuits of trying to find the thing that all rational people agree on. And it's done under the agenda of trying to find a place for a peaceable coexistence. And so the idea is if we can not talk about Jesus and we can not talk about the Pope and we can not talk about Moses and we can not talk about Muhammad, then maybe we can find a way to coexist peaceably. And so then what that does is it ends up kind of giving us a list of rules and principles that are kind of thought to be universal. So they begin talking about deeds and not so much talking about character.
Yeah.
And so those are two different kinds of sets of thinking about what you're doing with ethics and come out with very, very different potential solutions.
Okay. Let's talk about habits then. You know, part of what we want to talk about is the role of habits in human flourishing. As you talk about the difference between, I imagine it has to do with the difference between deeds alone, just actions that people take, and character, which is, you know, cultivated through habits, I would imagine. But anyway, talk some about that. What's the role of of habits? Like, what is a habit, you know, in your view? And then what is the role of habits in human flourishing?
So one of the, so going back to the cardinal virtues, courage, prudence, temperance, and justice, think about it. So the notion of cardinal comes from the Latin word cardo, which is the word for hinge. And so the idea there is that these are practices that are like a hinge for your life. And depending upon whether you get these in your life or not, it's going to have a profound difference on the direction of your life. and so courage, as an example of one of the four, you know, Aristotle has this line where he says, one becomes courageous by doing courageous deeds. And so it's a sort of, there's no shortcut for it other than doing it. And you only become this by doing it. And you have to learn to work at it. And so in, you know, one of my classes, I'll have them practice doing something hard every day and, you know, actually writing it down. And so the only rules is you're putting yourself into some sort of space that is difficult for you. And so it could be for, you know, and it's remarkable some of the things that they'll report that the hard thing is, you know, for some of them, it's going to the school cafeteria by themselves and not knowing who they're going to sit with. And that, you know, that can be their hard thing for the day.
Yeah.
But then they can work their way up to, you know, having a conversation with my mom that I've put off for like 3 years that I needed to have a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so they begin to reframe those kinds of things as growth and courage, which is a kind of meta habit or a meta skill for a much better life. And so that's the basic idea of you can literally train yourself for this.
Yeah.
And if you don't train yourself for this, then it's more likely in the case of courage that you're going to fall prey to cowardice. Or it could be that you're reckless and you fall prey to recklessness, but it's at the working of that, that you become a courageous person that then can do things in your life that you couldn't do otherwise.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Ben, you know what I love?
What?
My wife. But I also love theology and beer, and that's why we're excited to talk about Theology Beer Camp 2024.
Yes. Yes, it is a conference. It's a gathering in Denver, Colorado, October 17th through 19th that we got invited to participate in as a podcast. There's a whole bunch of podcasts that are going to be there. It's put on by Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity. And it's going to be a great gathering, Matt.
Yeah.
We're going to hear from Ilya Delio. We're going to hear from Brian McLaren.
Tom Ord.
Butler Bass.
Yep.
Tom Ord. Brian Zond. Lots of other folks. So we're excited to gather with you all.
We wanted to find some time to get together, and we're really happy to be invited into this, and we can invite you to join us here because I know many of you listen to our podcast, but you listen to lots of others as well. And there's, I don't know, 30 or 40 podcasts that are going to be there. Probably many that you already listen to, some you don't, but you'll be introduced to. So if you go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and enter the code GravityHobbit, you get $25 off. What a bargain.
Incredible bargain. I hope to see you there. Again, it's October 17 through 19 in Denver, Colorado. gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and use the code GravityHobbit to get $25 off tickets.
Yep, join us. This month's online learning community is on reconstructing the gospel of Jesus. We're talking about how his gospel of participation, how he participates in our humanity, and then we get to participate in the divinity of Christ and God and the Godhead himself. This is an ongoing series that we've done every fourth Wednesday. This month, it's on June 26th. If you go to the URL gravitycommons.com/reconstructing, you can sign up for a premium membership of our Commons community and get access to all the past classes we've done, all the past learning communities, or you can buy this just as a one-off, pay what you can, pay what you want to come and join us. Even if you can't join live, you'll get a recording. This class has been incredible. We've been reconstructing what is the gospel that Jesus proclaimed, and this is the penultimate That's one of Ben's favorite words. This is the yes. penultimate learning well community. So join us for this. I'm very excited. Ben and I will be in Louisville for this learning community. So we may even be on the same screen hanging out.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah. You'll know that we're both real people at that point. So not AI.
This
sense of your imagination.
This learning community is actually coming out of what we've heard listener feedback about how the Gravity Commons podcast has been so encouraging, and people want more theology, more Bible stuff, and to dive deeper in reconstructing a livable faith. Yeah. So this learning community is all about reconstructing a faith that is worth believing, worth living in 21st century. So join us Wednesday night, June 26th, 8 p.m. Eastern, for this learning community.
Yep. Again, you can go to gravitycommons.com/reconstructing to find the two different ways that you can register there. And yeah, this is like a big, it's a big Zoom call, essentially. Yeah. There's some teaching, but then there's a lot of time for Q&A for people to post things either in the chat or to unmute themselves. And so it's a really fun way to see faces and have some community around learning. That's why we call it a learning community.
Yeah. Let's learn together. Let's get back to the show.
What is it? I'm interested in the fourth of the four cardinal virtues, which these come from Aristotle. Is that right?
Yeah. Numerous philosophers, but yeah, certainly Aristotle.
Okay, but he kind of codified them, maybe. But yeah, justice being a virtue, I think I'm used to thinking about justice. You know, maybe talk more about that. I'm used to thinking about justice as like something that exists in a situation or doesn't.
Yeah.
But what does it mean for us to cultivate a virtue of justice, like or a practice of justice or a habit of justice? What does that mean?
Yeah. So for Aristotle, you know, we are social creatures. And since we are by nature social creatures, you cannot possibly have a flourishing life if you don't attend to justice, because justice is the practice of attending to social relations. And, you know, Socrates, Plato defines justice formally as giving what is due to the one to whom it is due. Now it doesn't help you a whole lot, but it gives you a helpful construct, right? So it's a question about equity. It's a question about giving what is due to the one that it's due to, right? And then obviously there's a follow-up question. Well, okay, to whom it is due and what's due? But if you start asking yourself that question, you're on the right route. Right. Mm-hmm. Because the whole presumption there is you cannot possibly have a flourishing human life or a flourishing human community apart from the practice of justice. And so it was just seen as central. And that's the way you frame that is an interesting kind of observation, is that in our day, we've gotten into this weird false dichotomous vision of you're either going to be a kind of a justice person or a person who cares about, you know, traditional Christian practice. Whereas historically, it's like you don't separate those two. Those always and necessarily go together. And if you don't attend to justice, you're not attending to what we're called to be. If you don't attend to interpersonal dynamics, you're not going to be what you're going to be. So even thinking about justice for a moment, you know, I've thought and talked and written a lot about justice and social justice and indispensability of that and the pursuits of all that. But sometimes what I see with, you know, some of the so-called social justice warriors is that, and I've been on the receiving end of this sometimes, is that they forget, it seems, that justice is fundamentally about fairness. Mm-hmm. And if you don't treat your opponents with fairness, you're not practicing justice, right? And so the anger a lot of times that comes out of justice work and the kind of cancel culture and that kind of stuff, people don't think of that as injustice, but it is. It's a form of injustice because you're not treating people equitably or fairly as you would want to be treated. And so the virtue traditions have this, I think, beautiful, compelling, holistic account of what it means to live a good life.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, most of our audience is Christians. So maybe bring this into the theological realm for us a little bit. You know, we've been talking, you know, virtue and ethics and, you know, philosophy a little bit. But what is, I don't know, like how, if you were going to talk about kind of what it means to live a flourishing life or practice justice from the perspective of the Christian tradition, you know, how would that sound?
Yeah.
Or, yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, this goes back to the earlier question you asked about, what happened, in the changes in ethics. And as I indicated, you know, one of the things that happened was that we didn't talk about narrative anymore, but narrative is about identity and community and what kind of people are we trying to be? Mm-hmm. And so this is where you get this sort of indispensable link between Christian theology and ethics is, apart from the narrative frame, you can't know what a lot of this stuff means, right? So going back to justice a moment ago, you've got justice is giving what is due to whom it is due. Well, okay, well, tell us more, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in the Christian and Hebrew tradition, you know, with the Hebrew prophets, they're going to say, well, it especially means you pay attention to the widow and the orphan and the foreigner. Right. And that would have been a unheard of kind of concern among some virtue traditions. They're like, no, you're concerned with those who are wealthy and powerful, you know, mm-hmm. and if you ever get concerned with those other folks, you know, you're going to give them, you know, you'll do some philanthropy and so forth, but that's not central to your concern for justice. So the narrative framework informs a lot about what the specifics of the virtues are going to entail. So going back to Deuteronomy, right, you've got in Deuteronomy's telling of what they're called to be and do, central up to that is you were slaves in Egypt and you were brought out of Egypt. So now you are a different kind of people than the ethic of Egypt. Mm-hmm. And so that informs Sabbath. It informs their economic practices. It informs the way that they treat the land, because it's not about power and mere treating humans as cogs in Pharaoh's wheel. Mm-hmm. Another kind of classic example of this is in Greco-Roman culture, when you talk about courage, the fundamental act of courage is whether or not you would go into war and face the fight, right? Are you going to run and be a coward, or are you going to be a real man and have courage into the fight and either kill or be killed? Whereas in the Christian tradition, we have a different narrative of a crucified Messiah. And so they then begin to have a very different vision of courage, and the culmination of courage for the early church is seen in the martyrs, right? Is that, yeah, will you be courageous before the powers that be and hold on to your faith and then be killed, or not? And that is the sum of what courage might entail in this narrative. And so it's a great little simple example of saying the narrative makes all the difference. Yeah. You know, you can have both of these traditions say that courage is crucial and central, but the specifics of how it plays out is going to depend upon the narrative, mm, and what the weight of the narrative and all of the things that the narrative points to as what it means to be a consummate human being.
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to giving, you know, giving what is due to whom it is due, you know, maybe in the ancient pagan traditions that would, you know, people with wealth and status obviously are due something very different than the poor,
right,
or the widow or the foreigner. But the Christian tradition and the, you know, the Hebrew prophets obviously would say, no, actually, they are made in the image of God. And so what they are due is your respect. What they are due is your, you know, love, you know,
right,
is what they are due, no matter how much money they have, you know, and that there's a sense in which, yeah, that narrative kind of really does affect everything.
Right.
I mean, this is striking to me, Lee, because I think, you know, one of the things that we've been wrestling with since really since 2016, especially since 2020, is the radical divergence that a lot of our audience has felt in people who all call themselves Christians, but have very different stories or very different narratives about what that means to be a Christian. You know, to the point, I mean, you know, we talk like this, you know, on the podcast, but like some people think that it, some people find it unthinkable. They probably don't listen to this podcast, but some people would find it unthinkable that voting for anybody but Donald Trump would be a Christian act, you know, could be anything but Christian. So they've got this narrative, they've got this story about what it means to be Christian that makes that feel obvious to them. And then of course we've got other people that have a very different narrative and, you know, make that seems obviously wrong to them, you know? And I think what's clarifying for me, I don't think there's a question in this. I'm trying to think if there is one, but I think what's, what I just wanted to articulate for you, that was clarifying for me in the, what you said was that we have just very different narratives. There's a theological issue here. It's not just right. an ethics issue. It's not just a, there's just a different narrative. And I think if we can see the, like the narrative, like you talked about of martyrdom being, you know, courageous. Martyrdom is the, you know, is a virtue. Whereas, you know, in a lot of versions of what is labeled Christian faith these days, martyrdom is weak, is, you know, they actually don't, they actually despise the cross, you know, in a lot of ways. And
yeah,
so,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. No, I think that's very right. And I think that so much of the trouble that we're seeing in American Christianity is a sort of basic misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the basics of the Christian narrative. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's definitely true of a lot of, American evangelicalism, but I also think it's true of, you know, a fair amount of American Protestant liberalism and some forms mm-hmm. of Catholic practice. Mm-hmm. Because it can be, you know, I think a lot of folks forget that, evangelicals did not invent American nationalism, you know, that
right.
in the American tradition, you have that much more from Protestant liberals, in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, they were the great Christian nationalists, you know, Woodrow Wilson, for example. Yeah. And it's not till the kind of middle of the 20th century or late 20th century that evangelicalism gets caught up in all this nationalism stuff.
Yeah.
Those narratives are powerful and they do lead to profoundly different ends of how we think about what Jesus is Lord means and entails, right?
Yeah.
Very, very different visions.
Yes. Yeah, I'm reminded of a David Bentley Hart quote that haunts me every once in a while, and I think this is it. I think I found it here. Basically, he said, "Let me put it this way: Christianity." His assertion is that Christianity never succeeded in America. most Christians think of themselves as Christians. However, the only religion in America that ever flourished was America, and it twists everything into its own image. He goes on to observe that American religion is about civil order, prosperity, capitalism, and a moral code that is not premised on forgiveness so much as upon judgment. Mm. I think that's one area where he talks about this. And then there's another quote that I think I was thinking of where he talks about something similar to say that like a lot of like the core narrative of Christian faith never really took root in America. And that's a haunting thought for me. That maybe we're just discovering something that that never actually took root, like in our country. It's always
I don't think I would disagree with him.
Yeah,
I think that so much of what we've thought about as Christianity, is actually the subversion of much of what Christianity is.
Maybe help us. Connect the dots, even in a bit more concrete way. I am interested in what you would say, for example, to a student who comes to you and expresses some concern or outrage over, at the time of recording this, maybe what's happening in Palestine right now, or what's happening in Ukraine, right? So these global conflicts that we know about because of the news, but there seems to be, you know, some very grave injustice happening, and they want to, you know, they want to do something about it. They want to be part of justice being done. How to that person do you talk to them about the importance of like cultivating habits, cultivating virtues, and how does that participate in or not? But like, I'm wondering how it integrates with and participates in this, this bigger vision that a lot of people have these days. They're just like, I want to be part of a solution here to this terrible thing that I see happening. There's a sense of injustice that demands action. Like, how do you connect the dots for somebody, who wants to be part of that solution, connect the dots to their own habits?
Yeah. Well, I'll try to speak just out of my own experience about the question you asked here of late. Mm-hmm. I think what Hamas did on October 7 was horrific and mass murder and condemnable. Mm-hmm. And I think that the retaliation by Israel is horrific and horrible, and mass murder and war crimes and condemnable. And I think that it's a very complex story, with plenty of blame, with a lot of players, and it's horribly messy and it's awful. And I've spent a little bit of time on the ground over there talking to people and, but in the middle of my own grief about that, I had, a really interesting experience with two former students. And one of those former students being a Jewish rabbi, and one of those former students being a prominent activist in Nashville. And they wanted very different things from me. The rabbi wanted to talk, and he felt frustrated and he felt misunderstood. And so we talked and we sat and we listened to each other and talked to each other. And then there's something he asked of me that, I intend to do in the future when the time is right. And then meanwhile, I have a colleague, acquaintance slash someone with whom I'm friendly, who I've visited with numerous times in Jerusalem, who's one of the most prominent Muslim scholar theologians in Jerusalem, who I, kind of immediately reached out to, and he asked something of me, and I did it. And it was something that I wouldn't normally do. And then meanwhile, I had another student, the activist student, who I deeply, deeply respect, who wanted me to sign a statement. But I declined to do what he asked me to do because I felt like I'm trying to be engaged with people on different sides of this issue. And I don't think that's going to help me do what I think I can do, mm-hmm. namely to try to be present to these two people and do what they've asked me to do. And so, the hard thing about a lot of justice issues is that it doesn't really matter what I say. And even though the Muslim scholar asked me to do something and to reach out to some people in power, they didn't care what I had to say, even though I did it only because this person asked me to do it and I told them I would. But they don't care what I think. And they immediately dismissed, with a boilerplate message to me that they're sending out to everybody that reaches out to them. They don't care what I think. And I can't do anything to change them. I think if what we're hearing in the press is true, that Biden is continuing to give billions and billions of dollars worth of weapons to the Israelis to do what they're doing, I think it's absolutely horrific. Mm-hmm. But Joe Biden doesn't care what I think, and I can't stop Joe Biden. But there are some small things that I can do that I'm trying to do, And so I think that with all of these kinds of issues, it's what is our local relationships, commitments, and our whatever it is that we feel like we are called to do or gifted to do or have opportunity to do or our sphere of influence. We have to take all that stuff into account and then do what we can do, right?
Yeah.
While trying to hold on to the other virtues of, you know, for me, I can be a very angry and resentful person about injustice. It just, you know, it pisses me off to no end. And I can ruminate and ruminate and ruminate. But meanwhile, if I'm ruminating, there are other kind of practical things that don't have anything to do with that injustice that I could be doing in my community and my family and my relationships in Nashville that I may get distracted from, where I could actually make a contribution to the world that I don't do because I'm angry about stuff that I cannot do anything about. And so I think, you know, it's difficult work to hold all of those things together. It's just not simple, and there are no simple solutions to that kind of stuff. But at least those are some of the parameters, I think, that are important in trying to take that kind of stuff seriously.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Just to draw out a couple themes that I heard you mention, I think one is to look for what you can do, like what kind of influence do you have? What are the relationships that you actually have? What's happening locally? What can you actually do for the people that you're actually in relationship with? How does that touch the ground there? And then, you know, I also related to that, I also heard you talk about, you know, there's embodied ways of being involved, and I think also just recognizing the ways that our access to all the tragedies happening around the world, which is a fairly new thing, right? I mean, mass media didn't exist. I mean, it's only existed for a few hundred years, right? And so, it wasn't that long ago that we would have had no idea what's happening in Palestine. We would have no idea what's happening in the Ukraine. And obviously, the fact that we do know about these things, and it's profitable for media corporations to like feed the worst stuff to us because that's, you know, what draws our eyeballs and our ears. We're drawn towards the horror of those things. And I don't know, there's a whole mess there that there's a systemic problem.
Right.
But, you know, on the human level, it just causes our nervous systems to get overloaded with trauma and horror.
Yeah.
And now one of the things we have to deal with, have to learn how to deal with is like, how do I, you know, stay connected to these things? Like, we can't change the fact that we live in this world, you know, that where we know all this stuff. We can't change the fact that we can know it. But how do we take care of ourselves so that we can actually be agents of justice in our actual lives?
Right.
You know, which might include, as you're saying, talking about issues that are, you know, far away, but talking in arenas and in ways that really do contribute to human flourishing for us all.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I very much agree. I can't draw up the name of the author or the book, but there's this very small little book written by a Quaker in the early part of the 20th century. And it's a beautiful little book about obedience and giving ourselves over to God's will, so we understand it. And he has a line where he says something like, we were not created to be able to handle the onslaught of mass media. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1930s, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just very sobering to think about how difficult it is to learn how to, this new season of human history that we're in. Mm-hmm. And it does bring a lot of difficulties with it.
Yeah. I wonder if we could maybe chat, you know, I asked a question about the person who wants to do something about the problems out there. and how, you know, habits relate to that. But I wonder if we could look at it from the other side of the coin as well, because I think one of the responses, I recognize this in myself, and I see it in a lot of other Christian circles as well, but one of the responses to the onslaught of all this, you know, trauma coming at us through mass media is to kind of tune it out, or numb it out. And so I think one of the pitfalls that I've seen, or tendencies, the temptations that I have, is to use my habits as an escape from the problems of the world, right? And so this is maybe the temptation to quietism, right? Which is like, I'm just going to do my little Christian practice. I'm going to do it over here in the corner, and this is going to be my self-soothing, like that, and that's all it is. And I'm going to let God, you know, God will sort out the rest of it, you know, all the political stuff, you know, what everything that's going on in the world. I'm just going to try to do my Christian practices by myself and tune out, you know, the suffering of the world. How can we avoid that pitfall as we do try to cultivate the, you know, habits and practices,
yeah,
you know, that can lead to and participate in human flourishing.
Yeah. For whatever reason, I just thought of a line from Peter Maurin, you know, who was one of the co-founders of the Catholic Worker Movement with Dorothy Day. And he has some line where he says something like, you know, discern the nature of the work to which you're called to do, prepare yourself to do it, and then do it. And I find that really helpful because it acknowledges on the one hand that quietism is not an option, right? It's that we are called to do good work in the world, and this is our grace and the gift to us to have good work to do. And so then the question is, okay, well, what is it? And then prepare yourself to do it, and then do it. So on the other hand, it's also this fact that you can't do everything. There's a limited number of things that you can do. And so, but get good at it and try to do it faithfully, creatively, in a compelling, sometimes provocative way, whatever, you know, whatever it is. And so, I find that helpful simply in saying, okay, yep, you got to do something with your life. And we need everybody to show up and bring their gifts and their abilities and their talents and their sense of calling to the world. The world needs you. And I'll tell my students this over and over again. We need you not to screw around with your life. We need you to show up and bring what you've got. We need you, right? But if we get caught up in this notion of trying to tend to everything, you can't do anything well. And so it's just this very practical, what's your thing, you know? And again, that doesn't mean that you can just be so narrow focused that you don't pay attention to anything else. But again, that's the virtue of prudence, right? The prudence is asking ourselves the question, what's the best way to do the good?
Yeah.
What's the best way to do the good of your own life or that you conceive of in your own life? And so it's prudence is a very fascinating virtue that's highly nuanced and many multifaceted. But I think those are the concerns I think that have to be brought to bear upon that kind of question.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I think the sense I'm getting from your answer there is that there's a, I think both in the temptation that I mentioned, which is to shut it all out, it's too much, I'm just going to do my little Christian practice over here. There's a reactivity to that. I'm just reacting against, it's too much. And so I'm just going to do this as a response to my own anxiety. There's a reactivity to it, but then there's also an anxious reactivity in responding to everything that comes across, you know, like whatever we're talking about on social media. Okay. That's the most important thing. And I'm going to let that dictate how I spend my day or what I care about or what I'm going to spend time reading today, that kind of thing. So I find it really helpful, that quote that you mentioned, just to have this anchor to say, like, I can be on social media, but whatever they're talking about doesn't need to dictate what I'm going to be about today, because I've discerned something
about what I need to be about. I've discerned something about the work that I can do in the world, and I'm going to spend my time doing that and, you know, becoming good at it. Yeah. And, you know, this is the best chance I have of making an impact and actually contributing to human flourishing.
Right. And, you know, and I think also there's this kind of question of, we should feel free, I think, to ask ourselves the question, you know, what's the, what's the best way to try to do what we think we need to do? If we do feel like part of our calling is to be aware of what's going on globally, then there are better and worse ways to do that. And you know, generally speaking, social media is not a good way to, is not by any means the ideal way to do that, right?
Right.
Maybe we would all do better if we, spent the time we spend on social media and read The Economist instead, some sort of truly more middle of the road publication that reports upon what's going on around the world. Mm-hmm. So how, with the limited amount of time we have to learn about things that we need to learn about, you know, there are better and worse ways to do it. So figure out a better way to do it that's not going to create so much anxiety and so forth. Because sometimes, you know, the sense of, I just can't do that. I gotta have a break. I think we should pay attention to that. And say, okay, so maybe what that means is taking Instagram app off your phone and saying, I'm not doing that right now. You know, for me, sometimes it's not listening to public radio, national public radio. It's because I can't take that right now. And I need to find more productive ways to try to contribute to the world. And then I'll go through seasons where I re-engage with that stuff. I'm currently on a sabbatical from The Economist, but I've been thinking the last couple of weeks, I think I need to pick that back up and do less of this over here and do more of that again. So it's, you know, looking and discerning and continue to look and work on it.
Yeah. And it's almost like the specific answer that each person comes up with is not nearly as important as the deliberation. You know, make it a thoughtful choice, you know, make it something. And this is what I'm hearing you describe as prudence, right? Make your life something that is thought through, you know, in somewhat of a careful way to say, what am I going to spend my time with? What kinds of things, you know, I've had that happen before too, where I, you know, for a season you would delete certain apps because I'm like, this is whatever, like that they've hijacked my brain in a way that I don't like and I don't find helpful. And so I will find a different way to find out the news. This happened a while ago, but there's somebody who kind of curates the news. It's like his whole job. And he writes a newsletter every day about 4 o'clock. He sends out like the 10 most important news stories that happened today. And so I was like, this is great. So I trust this person to kind of give me the lowdown, and I can read some of these articles, or I can just read his little synopsis. And it's a great way for me to stay, feel like I am up to date, because as a pastor, I feel like I should be on some of these things. But it's a great way to feel like I am up to date without, you know, feeling like I got to check Twitter every, three minutes to make sure I didn't miss anything.
Right. So, yeah. Yep,
yep. Which is what my brain had convinced me of.
Yes. season ago. Yes.
Well, Lee, this has been great. I thank you for your time. What are you working on? What are you excited about? What gives you some hope for the future? Anything that you can share with us?
I continue to be really super grateful. I get to do the work I do with No Small Endeavor because I get to talk to so many interesting, fascinating people. And so that I spend a lot of time working on that project and doing all we do with that. Yeah. I also, going back to the fact that I just got back from study abroad for a semester and being with just 10 students for a semester. And I was kind of, you know, I was living in the same villa with them and eating meals together a lot and teaching them classes. And, it just reminded me of how many really great young people there are in the world. And, that gives me a lot of hope. You know, it's like they're having to deal with a lot of stuff that I didn't have to deal with when I was that age. And they're trying to find ways to do it in a compelling way. And they ask good questions and they're curious and they care about the world and they care about relationships and they care about their friendships and they care about trying to live well. And that's very helpful to me. And I think there are just lots and lots of people out there like that, that we shouldn't lose sight of. And so that's very helpful to me. And then I guess third, I would say that it's continuing to see the riches both of ancient philosophical traditions. You know, I just for the first time, you know, I picked up a lot of it secondary sources, but I had never read, for example, Epictetus's Enchiridion, which was kind of his manual for character formation. And I'm like on my third or fourth time reading through that in the last couple of weeks. It was a short little book. It's like, this is amazing stuff. This is fantastic stuff. you know, I wish I had learned more of this stuff when I was 12 and 13 and 14 versus not learning it till I'm in my 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then at the same time, to continue to realize the beauty of the great Christian tradition, riddled as it is with all sorts of messes and even horrors. Yes. The story, I think, is true, right? And it is compelling, and its beauty of what it can call us to be in the world that is just sometimes overwhelming in its beauty and in what it makes possible. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so again, 3 months in Europe and in Italy, you see both the horror of the Christian tradition and how much crap it's done, but at the same time, to see how amazing it is and what it has called people to and the kinds of things it's made possible. And so I think it's kind of holding on to that kind of realism about it that continues to excite me and continues to make me think, yeah, this is just what a gift that we've been called to this and get to participate in this and do our bit, you know, in the grand tradition.
Yeah, that's really well said, Lee. Thank you for that. That gives me some hope too. and I think you really articulated well, you know, as you were talking about the Christian tradition and the Christian story. I thought, you know what, I think that describes really well why I'm still a Christian. Huh. There is a sense in which I don't know of any other story that makes possible what the Christian story makes possible. You know, just the beauty of the, you know, God, the mystery of the incarnation even, and just the God becoming flesh, and now we have a human God.
Yeah.
Like it's an incredible story.
Yeah.
It's an incredible story.
Yeah.
Lee, if people want to find out more about you, more about your work, or they want to connect with you, they can subscribe to the podcast, obviously. Are there?
Yeah, you can find the podcast on all the platforms at No Small Endeavor, or you can find me on social media, various social media platforms at Lee C. Camp, C being my middle initial, Lee C. Camp, or our website is nosmallendeavor.com, where you can sign up for a free newsletter and updates about all the stuff we have going on.
Very good. Well, hey, thanks for spending some time with us today, Lee.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Just as much fun as the first time. So thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, it was great. Let's do this again in 3 years, maybe even before 3 years.
Yeah, that sounds great.
We'll do it again.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.